This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballerman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballerman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 60, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Paul Tamala, expert on the upcoming changes in open banking, SVP at ACI Worldwide, member of the Payments Strategy Forum, and board member at Nexo Standards, to talk about PSD2 and the UK's equivalent of that. Some introduction to these hats. ACI Worldwide, founded in 1975, is one of those perhaps behind-the-scenes incumbent payments companies that most of you may not have heard of. Suffice it to say they do, wait for it, $14 trillion per day in payments. $14 trillion a day in payments. Interestingly, staff numbers are around 5,000. So to me, that looks like each member of staff writes out checks, or whatever the modern equivalent of that is, for $3 billion. Either their fingers move fast, or do you know what? Incumbents can use tech as well, or even better perhaps, than those assailing the castle might ever think. Lazy fintech commentators and those with little experience in FS, two categories summed up in many a LinkedIn so-called thought leader article, often talk about FS as if FS were basically almost entirely banks. As listeners to the show will know, it's far from that. There's a vast ecosystem of players into which fintechs are trying themselves to find a place at the table. In LFP 049, we had the pleasure of talking to Rich Wagner, chairman of the Emerging Payments Association. The Payments Strategy Forum is yet another player in the equation. I'll let Paul tell us more about that in a minute, and the whole meta process of how incumbents, startups, associations, and fora, the regulators and legislators, interact to produce the context for the FS world in which we all live. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Now, I was just telling you before we started the secret of my entire career, which was based on a Ronnie Reagan quote, which is about Hollywood, but clearly he applied it to politics, which is that once you can fake sincerity, you've got it made. Now, I don't think I can completely perfectly fake sincerity, but sometimes I fake sincerity. Anyway, so that was a very sort of droll quote, which people may have heard. But then you completely over-trumped me because you had an even better Ronnie Reagan quote story.
Yes, I actually went to dinner with him and Nancy at the Sherlock Holmes pub.
As one does. The Sherlock Holmes pub in London, in Baker Street.
Yeah, and it was his last tour overseas, and he'd written a book, and he wanted to come and do some PR, and at the time he was pretty deaf, he was, you know, he's a pretty old guy, and he wanted to come and not be a statesman and just do some normal things, and he literally wanted to go to dinner in an English pub. And through a friend of a friend's, I was invited to go and have dinner, and we had shepherd's pie and peas.
Oh, wow.
And then we went to see a play afterwards. It was absolutely fascinating. A lovely man. Absolutely lovely man. Whatever anyone else says about him, I'll tell you, very bright and a lovely man.
And this was sort of after he'd been president, obviously. I mean, I don't know, he must have been quite old by then.
Yes, he was. He was very old. And, you know, he was full of tricks. Absolutely full of tricks. We get to the Sherlock Holmes and he's ahead of us. And he jumps inside. And when we get upstairs, all the security people are going absolutely bananas. Can't find him. And upstairs at the Sherlock Holmes, there's a little museum. And there are two mannequins, Holmes and Watson. And what they'd done is they'd actually taken off the costumes, and he and Nancy had sat there in these costumes, and all the security guards are going completely mad until they found him. He really was, you know, a character.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I mean, another saying in life is quit when you're ahead. So thank you very much. And that's going to be the best podcast ever in terms of average anecdote on the podcast. And next week we'll be talking to you about something completely different. Although maybe I should continue for all my sort of subscribers who pay the grand total of $0 per download. Talking of deaf, you also mentioned, or going deaf, you mentioned that you're a member of a rock band in terms of making loud music. I don't know how that's affecting your hearing or what kind of rock it is.
I sing and play guitar, and we do gigs in and around the Reading area. It's great fun. Keeps me off the streets, literally. The guys and I go and play some music. It's cool.
We went to a local country pub recently which had a band on playing some music, and I've had a little bit of experience of music myself, but mainly in sort of the home studio. And we've just watched them setting up. I mean, how much kit needs to be unloaded from vans and plugged in and lights and mixers and all the stuff. And anybody listening with experience of music knows how. And these people must have taken, I don't know, it wouldn't have been less than half an hour, and it wouldn't have been more than an hour, just to set up a sort of standard rock band with about four people in it. And they tested it all, and then they started. And I felt very sorry for them, because the sound quality was actually remarkably poor. It was really thin, it lacked the sort of the bass end. The following weekend, we went to some country show or something, and there's one guy on the guitar, just playing in a little sort of marquee, and the sound quality was fantastic. And there was one difference, going back to processes, there was one difference in that at the second event, there was a guy who kept wandering from the stage to the middle of the audience, standing there listening, and going back and tweaking stuff. So what the first band had lacked was somebody at the front who goes, turn the bass up and that treble down, oh, for God's sake, you know? I don't know whether you've got sort of, it doesn't even need to be a sound guy, it just needs somebody who does the basics. I mean, of course, there's no end of level of perfection.
We have exactly that problem, because it's generally a friend of the band's who turns up and goes, you know, you're too loud, which is generally the case.
Yeah. And every band musician then goes back to turn it up.
But it is very hard to get that right. And, you know, especially in a smaller environment, trying to get the mix right is pretty hard.
And the acoustics of where you randomly turn up. So that leads very nicely, or not of the case, maybe. he said, glossing over, don't worry, I'll edit all this out, it'll sound very professional in the end, into this whole sort of thing that you do in your non-spare time, when you're not entertaining former presidents of America and covering Pink Floyd or whatever it is, which is the whole bunch of acronyms around PSD2 and open APIs and, you know, yada, 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 which I'm sure most of the listeners will know a certain amount about. I think the average listener will probably be a bit like me, that they will know roughly what PSD2 is, Payment System Directive 2, but not know what Payment System Directive 1 is, or when Payment System Directive 3 is coming, or have seen it's postponed, or yada, 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 and know that open APIs and all this kind of thing, which has been pushed by George Osborne when he was Chancellor, is about banks sharing their information more freely, and mumble, 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 but will probably be at the level of understanding that I've just indicated, which involves a lot of hand-waving and mumble, mumble, mumble. So going back to the biggest picture here, there's a process going on in Europe, which at the moment as we speak, Britain is still part of the EU as well as the continent of Europe. And so, you know, if PSD2 suddenly came in this afternoon, the UK would have to apply it. Separately and somewhat in parallel, even before the Brexit stuff, the UK was, and you can explain how in a minute, the UK was itself looking at its own kind of version of this kind of thing. So just starting and keeping it simple, for a listener who may never have heard of PSD2s or open APIs or whatever, what's the basic drive here? Why is this drive in the UK and Europe at the moment to do this? And, you know, kind of what is this?
It is the core question. And the reason behind it is essentially that the UK and Europe is thinking about payments from a much larger point of view. What's good for the UK? What's good for Europe? Not necessarily what is good for an individual bank. And that gives you a different set of questions. So, for instance, it is deemed that the use of cash forms a lot of the issues are around making people poorer, allowing terrorism to flourish, and so on and so forth. So the more that that can be turned into a digital electronic format, the more that it can be managed and we can, you know, look after where things are going. So you have a strong regulator that's saying what's actually the best thing for Europe to do or the UK to do, and therefore that is what these two programs are all about. And what they're really trying to focus in is how do you bring a series of competition in without the history that we've had, which has been, hey, this is my world, I'm going to block out all the small guys from joining. So it's really about bringing in different players to challenge the status quo so that there'll be better offerings, but moreover to make sure that we move into a cashless society so that those things I mentioned can be better managed.
It's interesting you bring the cashless one up as one of the sort of principal drivers of this process, because I've spoken to various people who say, oh, no, it'll never happen. But it's always struck me as an agenda here. It's subject of an entirely different podcast another time once I sort of get cross and paranoid enough with, I'll find someone sort of rebellious to talk about it. But I'm concerned about, you know, the ever-increasing growth of the state and tracking people more and more and, you know, every minute of the day and all this kind of thing. And so I'm actually concerned about the removal of cash from a sort of libertarian political perspective. It also locks you utterly into the banking system, so you can't, in a sense, have a 2008 again, because there's no cash to take out of the system. You are stuck in whatever system, however dysfunctional, created by sort of politicians' banks. Anyway, that's a whole political conversation for another day. Let's put that to one side. I mean, you're just telling it as is that that's going on. Equally, there are plenty of people in fintech who just love the cashless society and never touch money and walk around tapping and paying and yada, yada, yada. So it has that convenience. So like everything, no matter how thinly you slice it, it's got two sides. And going back to the competition thing, we've touched on this before, especially in the episode I mentioned with Rich Wagner, about the PSR, the Payment Systems Regulator in the UK, where Hannah Nixon is a very rare type of regulator, and that she's an economic regulator. She's trying to increase competition. And a lot of the regulatory work, that, of course, that you'll be aware of, has focused in the last 12 months that, oh, with hindsight, it's actually one thing regulators have been doing kind of de facto without really meaning to or thinking about it is actually preserving the status quo, because the last thing the regulator wants is a system to fall over. So it makes it more robust, more solid, make sure the big players are there. But actually, and that's good, We don't want our money to disappear. And it hasn't, by and large, when we've done payments. But as you say, that does lead to an inhibition of competition. Now, I can quite understand in banking why they've been so driven to try and sort of let people sort of nibble away at banking, because the banks did all fall over and we as taxpayers had to bail them out. I've never quite particularly understood why they're having such a go at payments. I mean, as I've said before to payments people on the show, every payment I ever did in my entire life worked. So the system, the Barclays and the ACI Worldwides and the MasterCards and that kind of stuff, actually works incredibly well. You know, 100.0% of my money has got where I wanted it to go. Maybe I typed in the thing in the wrong place the first time. So why do you think that, putting the cashless thing to one side, why do you think that folks are so driven by the need to introduce more competition in payments? I mean, the usual argument is, oh, you know, faster, better, cheaper kind of stuff.
Well, sort of, and sort of not. I mean, in the sense that, yes, you know, the payments get from A to B. It's a fantastic system, given the sheer volume of both money and the actual transactions that go through the systems. It is quite amazing it all works. But it is a very legacy, siloed-based system, or systems, and there are many of them. And that's good if you're a fraudster, because you go for the cracks and try and look at where the gaps are and exploit them. But it's also, and I would use the PSF as a very good example, of starting from the point of not necessarily what should we do with payments, but what are the issues that the end user stakeholders have. So for instance, if you're a citizen, what are the issues that you actually have? So for instance, a classic one to talk about would be you're a 0 hours worker, you're due to pay your phone bill on Friday, it's set up as a direct debit, it's due to go out, but you're going to get paid on Monday. So what do you do to bridge you across? You get a payday loan or you go overdrawn. Well, the cost of the payday loan or going overdrawn is much more. It could be 30, 40, 50 pounds in the UK. Well, you're only moving it a couple of days. So the actual detriment, as it's called, for the citizen, is pretty hardcore because of the way that the financial institutions have set up the infrastructure. Wouldn't it be better just to say, oh, well, hold on, can we just pay you on Monday? Is that okay?
Yes, I think that's an excellent answer, which is basically to point out that implicit in what I'm saying is my strongly conditioned by my entire experiences of what payments was in the first place, that what I've been doing is a narrow number of use cases. I'm not paid on Fridays and paying out on Mondays. I'm basically not paid. It solves that problem completely. But that's another thing about my insanity as a podcaster. So that's one example of where there's a use case which you can't really do. The other example, which is something that's never crossed my mind to do, although a buddy of mine who knew more about the interweb before it existed than anybody else in the early 90s said that actually micropayments are going to be what makes the web take off. Micropayments didn't happen. But what I can't do is, let's say you put one of your songs on YouTube. I can't go, oh, I quite like that. I'll give you a tenth of a penny. You know, and then your million listeners give you a tenth of a penny each, or for the podcast, a good example, probably a tenth of a penny is pricing it a bit too highly, actually, but, you know, maybe a hundredth of a penny. That kind of thing can't be done at the moment. You know, so I guess it's all these other use cases we can see. So you mentioned the PSF there. So I think that's quite a good time to get into, maybe you could give the listeners an overview of the process in Europe and in the UK, and then how the sort of PSF relates to the process and timescales and all that kind of stuff.
Well, let's start with the PSD2.
What was PSD1? Shouldn't we start with PSD1?
Well, actually, there was no PSD. Funny enough, there was no PSD1. There was actually PSD. And then there was a second variation of PSD. So PSD2, ironically, is the third iteration.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Plenty of fintech podcasts have started this year. And I noticed one was on 105. I thought, blimey, they've got fast going. But then I worked out they started with 101. So PSD2 is actually PSD3. That's my soundbite of the day, along with Ronnie Reagan.
So what's happening here is this is trying to get a statement that will govern all of Europe on how payments are done. And this applies to anybody within Europe that's moving a payment, or anybody that is now outside of Europe but is moving money into Europe. That's quite a big change. So if you're a US bank and moving money into the UK or France, what have you, then PSD2 applies, and it's a law, essentially. Then there are the introduction of third-party payment providers, which is relatively new, And that then essentially says you don't have to be a bank to be able to move payments. You don't have to have a banking license. You have to pass a technical test. If you pass the technical test, then you can move monies from A to B. And in the language of PSD2, there are LISPs and PISPs, and there's XS2A, which simplistically put is the initiator of a payment. So if you wanted to pay Mike €5, you're a initiator of the payment. Or if you wanted to look at several accounts that you had with different banks, being able to pull them up so you can see them by side by side. And to do that, you need to get access to the account. And the account is held by a bank. And in the past, that's been a very analog process where the infrastructure of banks been associated essentially around the account and a branch.
And keeping that information safe and within that bank only. Yes. That's how it's designed. Big moat around it.
Indeed. The problem with that, in many ways, it's got to a point where it's unsustainable. You know, from most banks will have literally, you know, hundreds of payment systems. And that is not a, you know, sustainable way to move forward. It also means that it actually protects itself from being changed.
Because nobody can rewrite the COBOL code that's right in the center of it. Yeah.
Indeed. Indeed. Or actually what the actual code was
reality.
So then the idea is to bring in these TPPs. And these TPPs will be able to get access, should you allow them to, you know, me or yourself, Mike. If you say they can, then they can. So if you want to pay a bill, you can give them the okay to be able to pay that bill. Or if you give them the okay, they can go and look at several accounts you've got and tell you where you are. So it's a credit card bill, two different account bills, so on and so forth.
I suppose pause on that one, because that's sort of a really clear explanation. Going back to my concern about the ever-extending reach of the state and the increasingly small gap that there is between all the various regulations and rules which exist in financial services as a whole. So we were talking about payments and opening up payments, but then in the kind of the quickness the hand deceives the eye, we're now suddenly talking about the openness of information in bank accounts, which is slightly different. Your ability to pay me $5, I get that, but I'm not quite sure, or maybe this is just how PSD is defined, because it's a payment system directive, as we say, or services directive, whatever it stands for, but it's not a bank account directive. In the UK, it's a separate mess, but how did it get run together in Europe? I mean, what is the connection between being able to pay somebody money and me being able to share my bank account information with other people? So it details the bank transactions, not my kind of sort code and that kind of thing.
They're two different things, right? So there's the account code. The actual account with inside of a bank is the holy grail of it all. You know, that's where the real information is. How you get information in and out of that currently means you go through this 0800 number for the card system, for the current account system, for the loan or the pension, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a huge, huge issue. But it also means that a third party, you know, a small startup bank, can't get in because it can't get access to that material. And it can't get access to the systems that are behind that, the schemes, whether it's an ACH scheme or it's a card scheme or it's an RTGS scheme or whatever these things are.
And just in passing, for those people who missed first shows in the payments of the past, schemes are basically the whole wrapper around the sort of how it works, basically for credit cards or for push payments or for pull payments.
Exactly. And the issue behind that, of course, it means that if you want to have access to the, you know, seven schemes that currently operate in the UK, as an example, you have to have a system that speaks to each one of them. So not only do you have to set up yourself to be a banking license, you have to set up all these processes and all these systems just to be able to look like a mini bank. That can't happen anymore. And what these regulations are saying is we need to make that a lot simpler. And if you want to initiate a payment, this is the way you do it. If you want to aggregate a payment, this is the way you do it. So the banks have to allow these TPPs access in to the account so they can look at the information. And if you allow them to, do the things we just chatted about.
I see. And in terms of the timetables at the moment, which are always shifting, what are the rough timetables we're talking about?
2018. Q1 of 2018, this will become law. Now, there are some issues around that. Perhaps you go on them another day, whether that moves out a little bit further. But PSD2 becomes law at that time. In this world, that's now.
Yes, exactly. So that's 2 years away. So, you know, given where we are on Brexit, we're still going to be in the EU in 2018. At this stage, we wonder whether we're going to be in the EU forever, but that's a different topic. And so going back to the Payment Strategy Forum, the PSF, so how does the PSF relate to all of this kind of stuff?
They don't relate logically in that view, except that the UK, as it did with immediate payments, which has changed the world.
Is that the faster payments, the FPS?
Faster payments, yeah.
And for overseas listeners, faster payments is the ability for, say, me to transfer to Paul's bank account today, same day, for no fee.
Indeed. And so, roughly speaking, in 2006, there was a view that there had to be a way to speed up the payments. And if we go back, there was five-day clearing. And the reason that that was in place was, you know, that's how long it took a fast horse to get from the north of England to London with a piece of paper.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't know that one.
Yeah, so that's why it was that length of time. But, of course, there were all the issues around that. And said, no, that's got to stop. Then they went to faster payments, you know, immediate payments. And now, it's common around the world. So the next stage of this is really then the UK Treasury saying, look, we've got to modernise this. There's all these detriments that, like we talked about before, they need to get addressed. We need to think about it from the end user stakeholder, whether that's a corporate stakeholder or more likely a citizen like you and me. What are their problems? What should we try and fix? And then work backwards to what the actual solution should be. By the way, all the people that are interested or you have a voice or who know, come and give us your view. We'll take that into advisement and we'll create a proposal document, which is what the PSF did, which was essentially the body that was set up to be able to collate all that information.
And how many people are in the PSF and, you know, what kind of folks are involved? Are they old FS and new FS?
Absolutely. And, you know, all sorts of charities, all sorts of end user stakeholder champions, clearly banks, startups, anyone who has a view on the way these things should be. But it's important to remember that it was against the actual detriments, the issues, not just because you're a bank, you know what's right.
And who set it up then?
So the PSR asked that it be set up, and it was set its own group, and it became four working groups, which was the end user stakeholder, financial crime, the access model, how'd you get into this piece, and how would you implement it, horizon scanning working group. And that in July became a public proposal, and that went out, and about 220 people from the UK came and listened to that, and there is a document online for people to respond to. And throughout the rest of the year, that'll be listened to, and hopefully by the end of the year, there will be a proposal that the PSR will review. And if they find it acceptable, then, you know, they will move forward with it.
I see. Because I do remember getting an email sort of last year along these things, which is, you know, would you like to contribute, da-da-da-da-da-da. But as I get about 100 a week saying, would I like to contribute to things for free, I can't actually do that. Otherwise, I would actually starve to death. So it's basically being birthed down to the PSR to go and do it on a mission, and then it will report back on its mission to the PSR, who will enable the regulation. And presumably, there's a sort of a tangent to that, which is that if some stuff can't be done through regulation, it then goes back to Parliament and government and turns into legislation, where legislation might be required.
Well, essentially, that's the link between the PSR and Her Majesty's Treasury. That's the link there. And at the event in July, it was the Treasury and the PSR and the PSF chairman that all spoke and went through. There is an alignment, and so far the feedback has been extremely positive from all parties, so looks like it's on the right track.
Yes, it's a topic that's come up many times, but again, to old sceptics like me, it's amazing to see government apparently adding value, as well as the challenging things. In terms of creating the right climate to get a better financial services system going forwards to serve people and corporates, incumbents and the new players, and touch wood, it continues in that direction. So, as I was saying before, when I was scratching my head about how sort of PSD relates to open APIs, because I'd seen them as slightly different things, which is how do we make payments more competitive? And on the other hand, banks are going to be told to stop keeping people's information just to themselves. And if I want to share my bank information with you or whoever, then I should be allowed to do so in a sort of fairly easy fashion, rather than having to go and photocopy a bank statement and send it to you and all that kind of stuff, which is slightly 19th century. We've been into APIs in the past in the episode with Stéphane Dubois of Exignite, who basically was there before APIs existed and does something like 10 billion a day or 10 billion a year, I can't remember, but lots and lots and lots. So we know what APIs are, but so what is the open APIs in this context that we're talking about on the PSD?
So just to be clear, the PSF and the PSD will not say you must use open APIs. It will say, you know, what are the things that need to get done. How you choose to do them is up to yourself.
So for example, I could actually buy a whole bunch of carrier pigeons and stick little things on their legs. And or it's presumably there going to be some service standards like thou shalt reply in less than the sort of 5 days that it takes a horse to gallop off that carrier pigeon to fly.
Indeed, which would be very interesting to see. So how it's done is up to you. but you have to do it. So the question then becomes, what is the most efficient way to do it? And I think just about everyone agrees that that just has to be around APIs, because what we currently have is so complex to handwrite bits of code to make sure you get every one of these things interconnected isn't going to work. So creating standards, creating the APIs will be the methodology that one suspects will be the way that people will move forward. Without it, I don't see how anyone can hit the timelines or actually comply.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that it was a requirement to do stuff rather than how you do stuff. But as you say, I think we can take as read that it will be that. And again, we've flogged this one to death in the past. But APIs are pretty much the Lego building blocks that have enabled fintech. Because if you had to sit down and write the code starting with begin at the top left of a piece of paper and do everything, including sticking in the YouTube videos and all that kind of stuff, you'd be here forever.
And in fact, the first open service call in the world happened in London. It was through Barclays. It was the first SOAP call ever set up. And I actually worked for Microsoft at the time, and it was done here, in Canary Wharf, in fact.
When was that? Which year were you talking
about now? Oh, gosh, about 14 years ago.
Oh, right. So that's extremely recent.
Yeah, in this type of technology.
In the scheme of things. And again, going back to the old days when I started in IT and that, computers didn't really speak to each other than with great difficulty. So it is amazing how much has changed in literally a lifetime. And, of course, it is all these changes, a bit like a rod of jelly, which have been given a good shove, and then the ripple moves down the jelly
exactly.
For quite a long time. So time's shooting by, as always. Where is this all going? What's the consequences of all this? I mean, we don't have a crystal ball here, but what's your best feeling of the range of expectations? So, for example, I mean, I said earlier that, you know, I can imagine the cashless society being a sort of complete dystopian nightmare where you're stuck into some system and it loses your money and, you know, Or actually, I can imagine it's just sort of actually much simpler and crime does go down in terrorism, although crime, terrorism, paedophilia just tend to be sort of bogeymen that are pulled out of the cupboard. I remember the euro being pulled out as this will reduce transaction costs. Yes, well, maybe, but it's also bankrupted loads of Greek pensioners. But anyway, so you've got to be a little bit careful of some of the sort of the rationale given. But so where's it all going? What's the sort of range of rosy scenario to pessimistic scenario? Or what do you think is a central scenario? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, to be clear, it's very unlikely that banks can move forward from essentially the, you know, decomposition of an analog world into a digital world without doing some of these things full stop. It's just too hard to do. On the other hand, you know, loans and payments pretty much make up all the profit that banks make. And either through access to the current account or the payments on top of it, that is roughly about 50% of the profit that the banks make. If that now gets moved to one side and say anyone can do that, then the question becomes, how does a bank make its money? What does it do? What does it look like in the future? And of course, we can paint this as dark as you like. But the other side of it, of course, is that banks do a lot of things really extraordinarily well. They have a huge network. They understand how money moves. They understand all the complexities, etc., etc. So I think what we're really looking at is what are the layers that will get removed from the system. And it's a bit like the Superman image where he says, I take all the half cents and I put them in my own account. Payments are a bit like that. You know, everyone takes their little bit across, a little bit across, a little bit across. Next thing you know, it ends up in quite a lot of money. So taking a lot of that away will mean that a lot of the financial institutions will be thinking about what is their strategy, what is their purpose, and what are they going to move into. And it's common held belief, I think, that data will be the way to move forward and truly adding value while making the platforms simpler for you and me.
So no pun intended, but I'm sure it's a good one, which is going to have people in stitches. But it is literally shaking banking at its core, literally and metaphorically. And it will lead to basically a large amount of naval contemplation in terms of what are we here for. You know, and as you say, the one extreme, you've got the sort of dumb rails, which is that British Rail just turns into a couple of pieces of parallel metal going around the country and other trains run over it. That's the sort of the pessimistic scenario. And you say the other end of the spectrum, well, it really depends upon what the strategic competitive response banks come up with to these circumstances. But this is why it's so fundamental. It's not a question of PSD 2, 3, 4, 5 or 6 or Euro legislation or what's happening in the UK or something else. But it really is actually causing the banks to utterly contemplate what they're in the business of. And that business changed. I mean, I went to a castle yesterday, it turns out, and it did have a moat around it. And, you know, the worlds of castles with moats around it was one kind of, you know, architecture of security. But when that sort of broke down, you needed a different architecture of security.
I think that's true. I think the other side of it, though, is I was working in IBM when the internet age came in, and, you know, such was the nature of the firm at the time. I was asked to go and spend 18 months, if you can believe it, to go and work out what the internet's going to mean to Europe. And so I was doing this jolly thing, and during this time it was going to be, oh, everyone's going to be disintermediated, nothing's going to be the same ever again. And you know, whether it is or it isn't is kind of a moot point. But what I can tell you is banks are still banks, insurance firms are still doing insurance, retailers are still doing...
People still go on holidays.
Yes, people may do them in slightly different ways. And I think that's probably the key here. There's the opportunity for banks to think, or, you know, and other, you know, FI institutions, not just banks, to think about what they do and how they do it and what they will become. But it's really about what their place will be in the ecosystem, where they were once the only kings to now being part of the ecosystem. It doesn't mean to say they'd be any smaller or, you know, or larger. That's not the point here, I don't think.
Good. Well, I think that's a good point to sort of wrap up this main section on in terms of where banks are going. I mean, going back to the dumb rails comment, which is always heard time and time again, as listeners to the show will know, it's one of my sort of pet yawns that so much commentary on financial services neglects the fact that money is not real. It's nothing at all. It's just bits in a computer. Money is stuff created by banks. Going back to the point to make about cash, we're pretty much cashless now anyway. 97.5% or whatever it is of money is just bits in bank computers. If banks weren't there creating money as we know it, there would be no money for us to do anything with. So it's not just a question of rails. The money creation thing is really important. So just wrapping up then, Paul, as I said at the beginning, you wear a number of hats, and I think it shows through in terms of you understanding in the round, both from an industry perspective, but also in terms of society, as individuals and as companies, where this is all going and how actually it could make it all more efficient. So in terms of your ACI hat, what's interesting at ACI Worldwide at the moment, and where's that going?
Well, I think that one of the key things that ACI has is a very unique place in the industry. So most of the industry is extraordinarily siloed, whether it's corporate banking and systems around that, or whether it's retail banking, or it's retailers and merchants. And there are governmental bodies as well, you know, Bank of England, for instance. ACI is unique in the sense that we touch all of the parties, and we understand what the stakeholders of each party is interested in. So to a degree, we don't mind which way the payments go or which way the chips fall, because what ACI is extraordinarily well placed to do is to understand the consequences of these changes, and whether a retail bank becomes larger or smaller, or a, you know, a corporate bank becomes larger or smaller, or a retailer becomes a bank, in fact. So ACI holds all the pieces and is in a unique place to look above it all and say, this is what we think and this is what we're doing. So we are really trying to think about this from our body of experience, which our competitors, frankly, and the FIs don't naturally do. They tend to look at it from one stakeholder point of view, or frankly, a siloed point of view. So our job is to try and think these things through. So this whole debate of where this is going is pretty much what's on the forefront of ACI's mind, and how to put ourselves there so that our customers can benefit from all the pre-thought.
Absolutely. Well, that's quite a nice summary. You started off with a rare anecdote about ex-presidents in Baker Street, and you've ended up with a relatively rare statement of a player. Say, I'm still impressed with my number of the day, that you people at ACI do $8 billion per day of transactions on average dollars, which is phenomenal, but that you're actually straddling all these various areas, and no matter how the sort of cookies crumble, you're still there in the centre, pulling it all together. And I don't think anybody who's listened to this show for a while has this naive, simplistic view of sort of, you know, it's kind of Star Wars view, which sometimes you still see about fintech, which is, oh, these exciting rebels are taking on these sort of evil empires. No, it's nothing like that at all. I mean, the incumbents are the one who have never, in my bank account, well, I tend to be with NatWest, whoever they're called these days, they've never lost any of my money in the bank account for 40 years. Every payment I've ever done works. So it is a tremendously robust system. And again, it's very, very naive to think that actually the incumbents aren't changing. I've said many times that over my lifetime in the city, it's been too much change of the incumbents that's caused problems, and too much changes of FS. If it evolved more slowly, we may not have had some of the problems we've had in derivatives and all these kind of things. So I'm really grateful to you, Paul, today for having come in and given us such a clear overview of what's happened here, and to reinforce the more grown-up perspective that the future of financial services is a combination of how incumbents are changing, how the startups are changing, how the regulation are changing, and all these other pieces, including things like Brexit, are all sort of revolving around, and that everybody is committed to trying to provide a better service for their clients, because that's how businesses thrive, whether clients are individuals or corporates. So I wish you and the Payment System Forum every success in driving this forward. It's the challenging difficulties of Brexit in the background and UK legislation and European legislation. And I hope that ACI keep doing their $14 trillion a day, if not even more. So thank you for that, Paul.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.